coming up on this week's Redcast.
What do we really need to do to describe the risk that the regulations are asking for? And what does good green data look like?
There's too much of an assumption that we can just produce unlimited amounts of information on absolutely everything, and that simply isn't true.
We're now into a decade of compliance. It's not just trying to figure out how we're going to solve the problem, it's how are we going to comply with the problem solutions that we have defined.
And make sure you get involved in industry groups where you can start to ensure that the regulations that do come our way and to our corporates that we invest in into their direction are ones that matter.
This is Regcast.
This is Regcast.
Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today.
Hello, I'm PJ DiGiammarino, CEO and founder of JWG, and welcome to Regcast, where we go through tomorrow's RegTech today. And this is a really special episode, which we're kicking off the season as episode 2 of season 4, which I'm really excited to bring you. Kevin Bourne is a great friend of mine. We've been together in the markets for, gosh, nearly 20 years. He's not your typical ESG data guy. He spent 25 years in equity trading at HSBC, Citi, and Solomon Brothers. The last third of his career, he's been in the sustainable finance and climate risk arena. And he's built a green data company, which really got him into the weeds of what is all this data that we need around ESG. And then he took that into what was now S&P Global Sustainable One investment research as part of his journey through market. Kevin, we met somewhere around 2005, 2006 when MiFID I was new, right?
Yeah, when MiFID seemed such an exciting horizon for the industry.
Yeah, and I guess the reason I wanted to key on that is it feels like we're back there again. I listen hard when people who did MiFID come to me with something new, and I think you came to me around about 10 years ago and said, look, we got to pay attention to this. And I have been paying attention to it, but it's only just now started to get structured and formalized. It's gone from voluntary data to mandatory regulatory reporting. And I guess that's a big shift because it means all of a sudden the controllers within a firm are now really accountable for making sure all this data is good enough. And I guess this takes us to a question of, what do we really need to do to describe the risk that the regulations are asking for? And what does good green data look like? So there are lots of firms now caught or beginning to be caught, and they're trying to figure that all out and tooling it much in the way a real markets regulation would look. And I guess that leads into then the first question, Kevin. I know you've had some great experience explaining this to people over the years, but what is the ESG and climate reporting problem?
Well, crikey, where do you want to start? I think we're time limited on the meeting today. I think we've got several challenges ahead. The first and most important challenge that people often forget is time. We have a clock ticking, and we're starting to see a range of challenges impact financial markets, particularly already from what is probably the biggest and most focused point of the ESG broad story, which is climate risk. We have impairments already starting to impact companies. And so regulation is reacting to that at a pace that I thought would not be surpassed, having worked through the MiFID journey with you on many occasions. But actually, the pace of implementation of regulation is quite breathtaking. So one of the greatest challenges I think we face is a lack of time to undertake an enormous amount of analytical and structuring work around data, not just across financial markets, but across all industrial activity and government activity, and then to do that on a consistent, comparable, disciplined, repetitive basis. And we are a long way away from doing that effectively. There are some great initiatives like ISSB to help us along that journey, but we still have a long way to go. And you made a very important point that this started as a voluntary type reporting requirement where different parts of the industry, decided they would put information onto paper because they were being asked by investors, typically. I think back to the carbon reporting work that came out of something called the Montreal Initiative, where RFPs for the buy side had to include carbon accounting data and emissions profiles for their funds. And a lot of the fund managers said, I don't see why I have to do that. Now that is simply a conversation you wouldn't hear. But we have a challenge that a lot of the regulation that's coming out is multi-jurisdictional. So think of MiFID in 200 countries, and you're heading towards the truth a little bit. We have obviously the EU going down their pathway, UK government on their pathway, the US looking to do the same. They're all in the same territory. They're all doing it slightly differently. The minor nuances that appear are actually quite important when you try to align data at a company level across portfolios. So we have a very broad challenge that is going to take a while to unpick. It's interesting, if you ask me, does the world need just one ESG, climate, green, an emissions definition? Yes, we've probably got close to that, I guess, with emissions. But with green and climate, and we don't have it. With ESG, in places we do, with natural capital, hopefully we will have. Because this whole subject, this whole sustainable finance subject, is really several issues that are conflated depending who you speak to and what interest they have over how they represent them and the impact they have on what their role is, whether they're an investor, a banker, a regulator, etc.
Yeah, I guess maybe before diving into what those different definitions are, what problems we think we're solving, can you just spell out a bit who some of these actors are? Because a lot of our audience may not be aware who it is that's making the rules now.
I have a slide that does that. Shall I pop it up?
Yeah, why don't you pop it on? And just, we don't normally put slides. In fact, this is the first time we've done it on RegCast. So you'll be able to find these slides on the video that will be on the JWG website, and we'll maybe figure out how to put a link to it in the show notes. But go ahead and pop it on, Kevin.
I can cover a bit of the history as well, which I think will help the audience. So starting on the left-hand side of the page, we've had voluntary standards for reporting these issues for a long period of time. You're going back 20 years, maybe 25 years, the first voluntary standards started to emerge, although the history of ESG, SRI, CSR, whatever you want to call it, reporting really goes back to the United States in the early 1950s. And some of the fund managers in this domain have a similar history. But on the left-hand side, we have a range of voluntary standards. Probably the largest and most used globally being the GRI, more than 14,000 companies using the GRI to structure and publish some ESG metrics and other data about the company that would not normally come out in their reports and accounts, the fundamental data. GRI has been well established now and been used by many, many companies, many tens of thousands around the world. But a whole range of other key voluntary frameworks. The UN Global Compact is an obvious one, looking at how companies act, and SASB more recently from the United States, TCFD, obviously most people will probably be aware of, looking at climate risk and the impairment to a company's actions and its plans around climate over the longer term. Over the last 5 years, we've also seen a series of what I define as industry standards appear. Again, voluntary, because these organizations, these industry groups don't have regulatory authority, but very difficult in many cases for the markets to ignore. If you are in banking and you're not thinking about things like the Poseidon Principles or PCAF in terms of how you calculate your emissions issues, in terms of your trade finance and your lending, then you're going to have a challenge because it's become, again, not regulated, but a commonly used standard. So we have a range of industry standards that are out there, probably the first and broadest industry standard that often doesn't get the recognition for the difference it's made to the industry is the PRI, which made sure that the asset management community were putting and managing their own ESG data, particularly about their investment funds, in a way that was comparable, disciplined, repeatable, all those good things that we like to see in markets. But over what's been interesting, I think the most the step change, to your point, is the introduction of these regulatory standards on the right-hand side. Now, some of the regulatory standards have been born out of the voluntary standards. Governments and regulators saw these voluntary standards, thought they were good, were often lobbied by the standard setters, and said, yes, we're going to adopt them. So you have something like TCFD adopted into regulation in the UK for 1,300 listed companies now, but not regulation in other countries. You don't have to make a regulator telling you must complete a TCFD report. One of the first broad market standards introduced by SEBI in India was the Indian ESG reporting requirements under their domestic framework. And it was a good ESG framework. The Hong Kong Stock Exchange also led the way. Europe, probably the most detailed of any of the programs in terms of all of the issues it's trying to cover, with CSRD, CSDD, which has just come into force at Christmas time, and SFDR just before that. So you've got the European collective bringing in some very broad regulations. I think what is confusing for many people is that these regulations are multi-jurisdictional. So you could have a business operating in the UK that's got operations in India and Hong Kong, and you are likely to have reporting obligations in those jurisdictions that might be asking similar but different questions to the ones you have to answer in the UK.
Yeah, and they're also, Kevin, they're also quite territorial, or extraterritorial in some cases, especially.
They are. And it's interesting to see how governments are reacting to the extraterritoriality that's applied to them. So if you're a US private equity fund under SFDR, and your client is a European pension fund, the European pension fund is not going to go through your investment structure and answer your SFDR questions. They're going to ask you to do it and supply them the data in the format that the EU requires their submission to be in. And you're seeing that not just in financial markets, you're seeing that broadly with the new European regulations across the corporate world, and not just public companies. What's interesting, this is now rolling down into private companies. Yeah. Over the next 4 years or so in Europe, more than 50,000 public and private companies and the entities of international companies that are above a certain size that operate in Europe, this extraterritorial issue, are going to have to supply information against CSRD, CSDD, and the framework within CSRD, the ESRS. And we seem to have fallen in love with acronyms, haven't we? I think an acronym Bible for ESG on a jurisdictional basis might be helpful.
Yeah, but also, I guess one of the key takeaways about that, though, is Europe has moved first and furthest in terms of setting these deadlines for some of this reporting, right? Do you want to talk through a bit what has to happen this year?
Furthest, yes. The depth of the regulation in Europe is quite significant. There are parts of the regulation, I think there's been a little too much speed and not enough thought about it. I can understand why the regulators have acted the way they are and why they have, but there's a limit to how much information companies can supply or want to supply. If I think of the EU taxonomy, some of it is very, very sensitive to the operating model of a company. I can understand why a company might say, well, if we publish this in Europe, but our competitors in China or America don't publish this, are we at a structural disadvantage? There's some interesting points to be raised. And then there's also the ultimate issue of who pays for all of this information to be collected. The banks and the fund managers use this data and are starting to understand how to use it really well. There's still some issues over the structure of the questions that get asked, difficult to use them in a quantitative way because the questions are qualitative, and the information vendors have often modeled the responses in a way that they want to provide a degree of normalization, which doesn't help if you're a quant because it means that somebody outside of the company might have altered the data structure. And that's to do with the way scores are built and constructed. But notwithstanding that, you now have this interesting exercise where you're getting more and more regulatory standards. The EU, as you said, definitely leading the way with some fairly sophisticated thought behind a lot of what they're doing. And now also you have had almost from inception really starting off with FTSE for Good, which for me was the first major ESG or use of ESG in financial markets. I know the other vendors are all going to phone me up and tell me I'm wrong, and I'll be grumpy with me for a while, and I'll be buying the coffees or the wine, I guess. But to me, FTSE for Good was the first real encapsulation of ESG into some sort of usable metric, certainly in the passive world through an index. And a lot of the work that's been done subsequently has been driven from that. But it doesn't matter, because the industry and the data vendors have now built their regimes to collect the voluntary data, the industrial data, the regulatory standards questions, collect that information, normalize it, and try and structure it in a way that is usable in markets. And contrary to popular belief, there is not as much difference between the scoring models as one might assume there is, although the differences that are there do create differences in scoring outcomes. Most of the ESG frameworks use the same sort of data collection structure, the same sort of data collection processes, the same sort of scoring structure, a 4 or 5 level scoring structure, but it's the nuances within that, the normalization of information points, the construction of composite, subcomposite scores, and how those aggregate up that create the variance in the information we look at. Well, that's important for people in the fund management and trading community, because if we have that much variance in ESG, potentially climate scores, but I think more in ESG metrics, we have an issue that you cannot do as much detailed peer group comparisons as you can, say, with fundamental data, where there's almost no variance. And when you look at the metrics and the research published by the banks, it's pretty much the same, unless they have a specific view on something the company's doing. But the metrics are pretty tight.
I guess that's one thing we hit upon in the hackathon that we ran with Finos including CSRD reporting. Was it wasn't so much the scoring models were different. It was the metadata about the information that were being provided to the banks. And the coverage, of course, you can't assume will be for everything. So you're then left as an investment firm trying to take multiple pots of data from different vendors that have slightly different meanings for what's a ton or what was the currency that was used to determine what the intensity calculation was all about, and those kind of things that could really trip you up. And I guess that kind of gets us into this topic, or beginning to get to, from a bank's perspective. Who owns all of this data, and how is it being managed?
That's a really, really important question. I seem to spend a lot of time on data governance, or more time on data governance issues. There seems to be amongst part of the community a belief that you can just use this data because someone's put it into the public domain. You can't. I think the ESG vendors and the data companies, as a general rule of thumb, are incredibly tolerant at the moment over how their information is used. That will change. There is no doubt that you need to read the back page of the source of the information very carefully over what you can and can't do. Can you create derived scores? Can you republish? And that's an issue that the industry will work through over time, and people who aren't necessarily following the rules will be asked to follow the rules or pay some money. But there are some broader challenges. If I think of the pain points, everyone seems to think about the challenges we have in the industry, whether you're a fund manager, an investment consultant, an investment bank, a strategy fund. It doesn't matter. You're acquiring this data and you're trying to build it into your investment structures, your investment activities, because the asset owners are saying, we want you to do this, it's important to us. I think as an industry, we're pretty well settled. I feel perhaps more for the corporates at the moment who are not set up to construct and manage data in the way that a bank or a fund manager or a data company, you know, be it London Stock Exchange Group, Bloomberg, S&P, Sustainalytics, these firms have infrastructure, FactSet, that's really well considered, well thought through. Still get it wrong from time to time. There's a lot of knowledge and understanding of how to manage large data sets. Now think of yourself as a large public company. And very large public companies often have data, often have supply chains, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 suppliers. One I know more than 80,000 suppliers who I did some work with. And they are faced, because of regulation, well-meaning regulation, Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive in Europe, to start collecting data on their suppliers. How does a large public company collect and manage ESG data, albeit only for the environment and human rights issues, but that's still a lot, across 20, 30, 40,000 companies? How often do they have to check it? How do they validate it? How do they have it assured? Is it something they've collected? Is it modeled? I think for the companies, the public companies and the private companies, having potentially now through legislation to collect these vast swathes of data, there is a very real challenge because it is not their business. The major data vendors, the banks, the fund managers, it's their business to handle and construct this sort of information, and control this type of information. The large companies, it's not in this domain. I think that is one of the challenges we face in our industry. We want to accept this data and to use it to make investment decisions better, cleaner, greener, more just. And the poor companies, public and private companies, are saying, how on earth do I do this? This is not a small undertaking for any business.
Or for any of those investment firms as well, right? Because they're going to have to make lots of assumptions.
Yes.
Based on that will change over time. And they'll make those assumptions based on a variety of different things you can hear or read, or you know, assumptions that one will make. But talk me through, what does it mean for the controller's point of view now that this has to be auditable? You have to be able to prove that you had the right data. What does that mean now at your bank?
I did a workshop for a small the UK branch of an international bank recently. There's a board meeting there in London. It was a Friday afternoon. And I think what was so interesting for them was this. I segregated their work into three blocks, really. So there was themselves as a company, as a bank. They had a range of reporting obligations. I'll drop on us, bump on a couple of slides, because this is the slide I actually talked them through. So they've got their Section 172 under the UK Companies Reporting Act, where they're looking at additional data, in this case, putting ESG data into their annual reports and accounts. They've also got SECA, the emissions reporting information. Interesting one that often gets missed, if they're a company in the UK or an overseas company and you're applying for a UK government contract, any part of government, greater than 5 million ex VAT in value, you've got to do a net zero business plan. I call it a business plan, a data submission. Very few people understand that, or you are at risk of losing the contract or being knocked out in the first round. A little bit like the emissions modeling that came out of the Montreal protocol those years ago. So you have, for a bank as a company, reporting obligations, and those are going to increase. You also have on the left-hand side the PRA and the FCA saying, giving them reporting obligations as a bank. And then they have to look through their business model and decide, what are we actually going to report against? Well, in the blue box in the middle, your corporate ESG and climate profile for yourself as a business, just as other companies are going to have to do. And if you're unlisted and you don't have TCFD, it's going to be something probably in your Section 172 statement. You've then got all these orange boxes to deal with as a bank, your operational footprint. So what is the impact on your operational footprint? Your balance sheet risk, so particularly climate change for that. Your counterparty risk, because you want to know what your counterparty's risk profile are, because systemic risk, particularly for climate change and for human rights, is a real issue. Your product design, do your products actually now meet the criteria that they're acceptable? You've now got SDR in the UK and anti-greenwashing constraints coming in and an increasing number of prosecutions on that basis. And then you're managing your information management. And what I said to them was, probably the best way to manage this is as a frontline risk issue. Think of collecting, managing, and reporting ESG climate data and climate data as a risk issue, and put it onto your risk register that you've got to follow the requirements. First line, second line, third line, risk processes, risk professionals who are not subject matter experts, but they are risk experts. And I think this is becoming such a broad issue, particularly with multi-jurisdictional, customer and domestic regulatory impact. You need to treat it as a full-blown risk issue. Big banks are doing that. Big institutions are doing that. Some big companies are doing that. Smaller ones, not yet on their radar. For me, complying with and staying in line with these rules and regulations that are only going to increase is fundamentally a risk issue.
And I guess that's, it's almost like a parallel set of controls and structures to what happens today for the markets and all the other risks that we're controlling, but it doesn't necessarily exist yet, right? So that these are all new definitions, new concepts and structures that people need to get in control. How what does that mean from an organizational point of view?
That's a great question. And that was actually one of the questions that was asked when I did the workshop for the board of this bank. And my answer was a fairly simple one. We're not going to have less regulation in this domain. We're only going to get more, and hopefully with international standards like ISSB, IFRS S1 and S2, it'll become easier. But if you know the regulation is coming within a range, you know what the broad spectrum of that regulation is going to be, get ahead of the curve. Don't wait for it to turn up. It's a more complex issue than you realize. If you're a bank and you want to start looking at the impairment to your balance sheet, you want to start using things like PCAF to do some of the emissions analysis within your operating model. It's a more complex issue. There's layers of the onion. Don't just think it's a bit of ESG reporting. It isn't. So my comment to them was start now. Even though in the UK we haven't quite decided what we're going to have here, we talk about SDS in the UK being very close, the Department for Business and Trade's reporting standard for companies being very close to IFRS S1 and S2, but they've put a caveat in unless it isn't right for the UK. But actually, that's quite a big caveat. They can do a lot by changing things. There is not still in IFRS S1 an effective common ESG data set that's company or sector neutral. They've got the 77X SASB sectors and subsectors. That's great. But what do you do about standard data that everyone needs to answer? So the EU in their ESRS framework have gone down the non-sector route. They said, here are the key issues you need to answer. So I think for any board or any senior management team, it's get to understand the structural history, get to understand what regulation in countries you're going to operate, get it as a risk register issue, get your project plan put together in detail, and don't wait for the regulation. There's things you can be doing now. Some are, it's varying degrees. Different people I speak to seem to have different levels of engagement at the moment. Many at the moment still have almost nothing. They might have done their Section 172 reporting in the UK, and that's a nod towards the subject. There's not any sort of internal deep dive on metrics yet, but it's coming, and coming fairly quickly.
And I guess then if we have literally thousands of firms trying to work out what these risks are and how to manage them, we have a mutualization opportunity, right? There ought to be more we could be doing here to figure out how to do this in a common and standard way. You may just want to move my window off the screen because I can see it now.
Sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
Sorry about that. Sorry about everyone listening. There's a computer error. I'll stop the screen sharing. That'll be easier.
There we go.
Then I can move you around without making you three people.
So joint working groups. In MiFID, we had to really slice and dice it and figure out, okay, what was the best execution work stream like? What did people really want out of there? Tell me about the opportunity as you see it for mutualization.
I think we need to learn from the lessons of the past and start to repeat them. There's not enough broad-scale discussion. Organizations like yours who understand how to do this can be leveraged. I would ask if you're doing, if you have any work programs with the British Bankers Association, particularly helping the younger banks in the UK, that's an area where the BBA have the ability to convene and you have the ability to run programs like this with an understanding of what needs to be put in place to be effective. So I think we need to start joining some dots together. As I said, the most important thing for me is we are short time. There's a bit of an issue that I have, a personal question I ask, is all this information we're going to collect actually going to reduce the amount of CO2 and methane that gets emitted every day? And if so, when will it start happening? I think everything that's being done in markets and in broad industry is really necessary. We've been industrializing for 250 years and nature's making asking us for payback and making us suffer. Perhaps rightly so, we didn't pay enough attention to science, which we knew many, many years ago. But notwithstanding that, we now have to organize, structure, manage ourselves. Programs like yours, which I've supported and been involved in for a long time, are absolutely key. Strange enough, I don't see a huge amount of that happening at the moment. Around regulation, where the FCA or somebody or the ESMA bring a working group together, people will get involved, but it's not broad enough. It's not got enough outreach. ISDA have done some work, and I've done a little bit of work with ISDA and with trying to think of the risk organization. Sorry, guys in Dublin, you're going to send me a grumpy email. I can't remember your acronym. So I see things starting to happen, but not enough. I think there's a real important place now for groups like yours to start saying, how do we all come together, not just for one-off initiatives like PCAF or like Natural Capital, but as a broader response and a broader response back into the policymakers to say, let's just focus on what's really important and what's really material, not on everything we've ever wanted to make companies publish because we think it's a good idea at the moment. Because there is, I think, a very material risk of reporting overload where there is, I'm not saying it's unimportant, it's all important, but there's grades of importance at the moment. I don't think we've done enough to understand what are the grades of importance. And for me, the most important information block that should be reported is anything linked to climate risk, because quite frankly, nature's not going to wait for us.
Yeah, it's really important to emphasize the time there. And I think, you know, as with anything in this sector, you really need a deadline to drive things, because that's what will we'll bring the people to the table. So, you know, the unit of currency right now is meeting hours. Who is willing to go to the meeting to begin to sort some of this out? And I think you're absolutely right. There are little points of light. I'd also call out FinDebtX as a effort that has kind of gotten some traction. But we're moving to a whole different world. I mean, this is going to be XBRL, right? This will be like filing your corporate return. And there's all kinds of machinations that will have to happen to think about, well, what is a good XBRL return for CSRD look like, and how do you pull that together?
There's part of the challenge. If you look at information that gets published by companies and consumed by financial institutions, I think the information they publish in this domain falls into three broad groups. Information that's important, because we need to track and monitor how companies function with society and the impact they have on society. It's important, but does it actually change value or price? Probably not. Information we need companies to publish because it's linked to dealing with the outsized risk that climate change is and is becoming. With the climate destabilizing in ways that we hadn't necessarily thought of. Climatologists think in decadal time periods, and yet the growth, the disruption to the jet stream in the northern hemisphere, the creation of the heat domes over the last 5 years has been in 5 years, so sub-decadal. And the climatologists have now a chronic event that is extreme that was not built into any of the long-term historic AR reports as something that they predicted was going to happen. So Mother Nature's throwing some curveballs at us, and they're pretty damn serious ones. Then there's information that is in its own way price sensitive, time sensitive in markets. And if you looked at ESG frameworks, and I've built several now, there's a very small group of questions that a trader could say, well, if I have that information on a hedge fund, because if I have that information, I can make a relatively short-term assessment over a signal from that information and trade it as such. I do think the trading community, my old alma mater, is going to be much more involved. I think we're going to have to understand how we can hedge climate and how we can construct climate into broader industry. I registered a website, Climate Default Swap, just to see what happened.
Well, that's great news. It's music to my ears whenever you get the front office involved, because that's where the money is. And they can help begin to structure and collaborate in a much, much broader way. So that's an awful lot of great insight, Kevin. And thank you very much for sharing it with us. Talk to us in conclusion. What's your 60-second takeaway for 2024 in this space?
Pay attention to the detail, even if you don't understand it. Track the regulation. I spend 2 hours a day reading regulation. I don't know if I really want to admit that, but I do. And I still don't know it all, and I never will. There's too much happening too quickly. And make sure you get involved in industry groups where you can start to ensure that the regulations that do come our way and to our corporates that we invest in, into their direction, are ones that matter. So groups like yours should be lobbying government and regulators on a more regular basis, because there's too much of an assumption that we can just produce unlimited amounts of information on absolutely everything, and that simply isn't true.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's a lot we can learn from derivatives and other big reporting efforts that we've been in the middle of for years now. So I guess that's a great segue into what's next for JWG. We're really looking forward to our annual conference, 7th of February, and physically in London. We will have XBRL and Goldman Sachs and a few of the other key players on the panel talking about what we'd like to do here. I really would like to reach out to those trade associations too, maybe see if I can't get UK Finance involved a bit in the what's next conversation. But we'll look to move that on. But key for us is to continue with the momentum we got last year with the Finos hackathon, where we were looking at what open source tooling could be out there. Because I think open source could be a key arrow in the quiver for the whole ESG problem. Because if you can just download things and be able to download it from the GitHub and be able to access that cloud library of data, it makes people's lives an awful lot easier. So I guess in conclusion, I'll just wrap up with one thought that struck me in listening to Kevin and reflecting back on the hackathon from last year. This is really going to be a whole different decade for everybody involved in ESG so far. There's lots of different angles on it, but we're now into a decade of compliance. It's not just trying to figure out how we're going to solve the problem. It's how are we going to comply with the problem solutions that we have defined. And that's going to be an amazing journey. And as Kevin says, can't get started too soon. So looking forward to continuing this conversation. We'll have more RegCast coming at you in this space soon. And thank you. I just wanted to leave Kevin with another tip of the hat for some great slides. And thank you for helping to pull this all together for us.
PJ, thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure to be here and to help with the outreach to the market.
My pleasure, Kevin. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening. And if you've enjoyed the content, please like us so more people can join the conversation. Download all our episodes via all the major platforms. Come to the JWG website, which is jwg-it.eu, and follow our LinkedIn groups.